Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we need to continually learn as we keep on getting exposed to how well they defined this Constitution and created the clarity. Like the court, the courts need to adapt to the state's legal system, not inflict the legal system upon the states. I hope you're getting this. I hope you're understanding how, you know, the courts and the Bar Association, you know, without us really noticing anything, under our very noses, they created a judiciary form of government. They took our Republican form of government and made a judiciary form of government. So all that being said, it's all about focusing on full compliance with the Constitution. We have to be myopic. We have to be singular in ensuring that every facet, every part of the Constitution must be adhered to. Therefore, as we kind of dive into these debates, and we're actually talking about the North Carolina ratification debates, we're now covering, again, the one part that I really want to highlight. And we were just covering that with Tammy, she's here, folks. Don't worry, it's not going to be GR. Yeah, there you go. It's not GR's all by himself, and he's going to be, you know, having to entertain and do a soft shuffle and you know, anyway. So what we have is this really good diatribe regarding the power of attorney, because that's how he starts this off. And so I'll have Tammy read this, but I want to, because we kind of covered this yesterday, and I want to talk about it. The absurdity that they point out, how imbecilic it is to think that one could actually list every enumeration or list all of the types of rights that we would want to protect. Even they knew that down the road, new things would be done. So I'm going to give you an example. Because the Fourth Amendment basically says that, actually, I won't even basically say, let me cite it. So let me go into the Fourth Amendment. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. Now, I'm going to stop right there. Now, today, what you consider your persons, your houses, your papers, your effects, because it didn't say property, the courts have basically considered the open fields doctrine, meaning that now they can actually check and search for your things. If it's out in the garbage can on the street, then you've surrendered your control over that. That's how the court goes down the path of saying you have a full right to be secure in your persons. Now, here's the question. Because they didn't include the property, because they didn't include the computer and your network communications and those communications that you're making, that wasn't construed in the Bill of Rights, that means that they can actually go and look for things. Because really the thing is this, that these things shall not be violated. And no warrant shall be issued but upon probable cause. So in other words, the only way the government can actually, you know, start collecting information on you is they have to have the writ of a warrant with probable cause. Okay? That's what they're saying here. And that's the intent of this right. Oh, but you didn't list the internet and you didn't list your property. You got this big, huge field. And so if they go over there and they, you know, can listen and hear things from in the open fields, then, that becomes open to the domain. You're not secure there. No. When government wants to actually start investigating you for information on a crime or something that they actually have jurisdiction over, again, they got to have jurisdiction over it, they have to have a warrant. In other words, before they create the little envelope, or I should say the folder with your name on it to start putting information in, before they even do that, they've got to go see a judge. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in concept, because we have the Bill of Rights, doesn't mean that now the anything that's not listed here is open. No, no, these are just further declaratory because they wanted to make sure you're not going here. But the still the same premise is that only these are delegated. So does the federal government have any ability to search, seize, or go down this path of, you know, investigating citizens of the United States? Is there anything in the Constitution granting them that power?
No.
No, not at all. Therefore, they have to at least go down this path. And so the Bill of Rights actually kind of created this, the principle of the path. If you're going to investigate anything, collect data on any person, then you must have a warrant for that. And so hold on here. What is the NSA doing? It's vacuuming up and it's collecting all of this data and it possesses all of our communications. Huh. Well, how do they do that without a probable cause that they need to have my communications or yours? See how they've skirted things. This is how they've skirted things. And it's really clear here that government can't even, like I said, they can't create the folder without the warrant. Why create the folder when you don't even have an assurance that the judge is going to allow you, based on your cockamamie probable cause, to start investigating people? Now, this only protects U.S. citizens. It doesn't protect illegals, or I should say invaders. It doesn't protect state nationals. It doesn't protect people who are not a U.S. citizen. Only citizens are protected in this country, baby. That's it. That's why the Constitution constantly pointed to citizens. This is why everybody under the original Constitution, like right here, as we look at the Bill of Rights, or if you actually go into Article 4, the citizens of the United States, and this, literally, it's even in Article 1, Section 8. The point is this, folks, that people wanted to become citizens because they wanted these levels of protection. Why not? Why not have government constrained to keep from actually harassing you? If you're a citizen, they can't harass you. Oh, okay. But if you're not here legitimately or a citizen or what have you, then they can. And the courts have come along and said, oh, no, you can't even do that. You know, the courts have literally created the paradigm that every citizen on the earth, every person on the earth, is a citizen of the United States because they're entitled to due process. Why? Well, shoot, why don't we mail ballots out to every citizen on the earth and allow them to vote in our elections as well? Because that's where the courts are taking us. They're extending rights and access to anybody and everybody. It's that ridiculous. So, when we're looking at this, again, I want to point out that the Bill of Rights and what he's basically talking about, does it mean that because it's not in the Bill of Rights, because we now have a Bill of Rights, if it's not there, then they can actually start doing things? No, the concept of enumerated power still exists, very specified. If it is not delegated in the power of attorney, they can't do it. Even though we have a Bill of Rights to constrain them further, but further declaratory negative things upon them, doesn't mean that, oh, because we've listed speech, now they're going to actually start ruling on speech that money is free speech and that you can use your money to actually, you know, support somebody. I mean, this is how far the courts have gone, well outside their authority, well outside. Anyway, so I am done scolding and I'm done with this rat hole, but I want to kind of use this to kind of set the stage and finish going through what you were trying to read here, because this is really, really good stuff. So go ahead.
Where did you want me to start?
Start with, it may be considered as a great power of attorney.
It may be considered as a great power of attorney under which No power can be exercised but what is expressly given. Did any man ever hear before that at the end of a power of attorney, it was said that the attorney should not exercise more power than was given, than was there given him? Suppose, for instance, a man had lands in the counties of Anson and Caswell, and he should give another a power of attorney to sell his lands in Anson. Would the other have any authority to sell the lands in Caswell? Or could he, without absurdity, say, 'Tis true, you have not expressly authorized me to sell the lands in Caswell, but as you had lands there and did not say I should not, I thought I might as well sell those lands as the other.' A bill of rights, as I conceive, would not only be incongruous but dangerous. No man, let his ingenuity be what it will, could enumerate all the individual rights not relinquished by this Constitution. Suppose, therefore, an enumeration of great many, but an omission of some, and that long after all traces of our present disputes were at an end, any of the omitted rights should be invaded, and the invasion be complained of, what would be the plausible answer of the government to such a complaint? Would they not naturally say, 'We live at a great distance from the time when the Constitution was established. We can judge of it much better by the ideas of it entertained at the time than by any ideas of our own. The Bill of Rights passed at that time showed that the people did not think every power retained which was not given, else this Bill of Rights was not only useless but absurd. But we are not at liberty to charge an absurdity upon our ancestors who have given such strong proofs of their good sense as well as their attachment to liberty. So long as the rights enumerated in the Bill of Rights remain unviolated, you have no reason to complain. This is not one of them. Thus a Bill of Rights might operate as a snare rather than a protection. If we had formed a general legislature with undefined powers, a Bill of Rights would not only have been proper but necessary, and it would have then operated as an exception to the legislative authority in such particulars. It has this effect in respect to some of the American constitutions, where the powers of legislation are general, but where they are powers of a particular nature and expressly defined, as in the case of the Constitution before us, I think for the reasons I have given, a Bill of Rights is not only unnecessary, but would be absurd and dangerous."
Okay, so in that very last line, he basically says, it has this effect in respect to some American constitutions. I came out and said this, that not one of the constitutions was anything like the United States Constitution. And he basically is stating here that most of the state constitutions are general. In other words, the state's general powers exist. They can do anything they want to. And nobody's scared about their general the general powers being at the state level. Are you kidding me? We're already seeing how our states are assuming general powers, even though they do have constrained and they don't have the authority to do what they're doing. They're doing it because they're assuming general powers, in contrast to them actually only having enumerated powers. And so this is where he basically lays this out. And I'm hoping that everybody's kind of created that connection. Just because the Bill of Rights exists didn't change the design and framework of the Constitution being specified and limited. Oh,
right.
In other words, the Bill of Rights, because we added a Bill of Rights, did not convert our specified and limited power of attorney into a general power of attorney. In other words, it only created extra super negatives. That's all. Not doors for the court to come in and say, you know, there's this right to privacy. No. So, one of the things that it does actually do is that actually the Bill of Rights actually provides us with some very positive rights of the people that were a part of common law. The common law right of assembly and petitioning government for the redress of grievances, that goes all the way back to the Magna Carta, the Glorious Bill of Rights. And it was the courts that literally rewired everything. And so when we go through these definitions. What we're really giving you, folks, is how the Constitution has been clearly stipulated to make basically anybody, if you read the ratification debates, it turns the Constitution into stupid proof. I mean, you can't be dumbfounded with, you know, these lawyers' legal speak to say, oh, well, we've got this case law, and we did this and this and this and this. And they go through this maze of, you know, these laws, or I should say, these cases where the opinions literally transform the law into something that is not even recognizable. Do you think the design of the Constitution was to allow the courts to do that? I mean, think about this, folks.
Definitely not.
As I've said time and time again, the reason this Constitution did not touch the states and their form of government was because it was to serve the states, not to control them. And yet, the federal government has been working and working and working to control, and the judiciary was leading the way. And when the Congress actually saw the judiciary doing such great jobs in actually perverting the law, They stepped back and said, you know what, we need to unleash these guys. These guys are doing it. This is great. We're gaining power. Let's go down to the next, I'll just say, section that they want to dive into. So this is actually Tuesday, July 29th. And there's some more by Mr. Davey that's talking about jurisdiction and then interposition. So let's go ahead. We got 7.5 minutes. I think we can get a good chunk of this done. Thank you so much.
Okay. It is necessary in all governments, but particularly in a federal government, that its judiciary should be competent to the decision of all questions arising out of the Constitution. If I understand the gentleman right, his objection was not to the defined jurisdiction, but to the general jurisdiction, which is expressed thus. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority. That was a quote. And also the appellate jurisdiction in some instances. Every member who has read the Constitution with attention must observe that there are certain fundamental principles in it, both of a positive and a negative nature, which, being intended for the general advantage of the community, ought not to be violated by any future legislation of the particular states. Every member will agree that the positive regulations ought to be carried into execution, and that the negative restrictions ought not to be disregarded or violated. Without a judiciary, the injunctions of the Constitution may be disobeyed, and the positive regulations neglected or contravened. There are certain prohibitory provisions in this Constitution, the wisdom and propriety of which must strike every reflecting mind and certainly meet with the warmest approbation of every citizen of this state. It provides that no state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any imposts or duties on imports or exports except what may be absolutely necessary for executing its inspection laws. That no preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another.
Okay.
And that no... Go ahead.
Because that's red. And because this is a key point that I wanted to make. So there's certain things I wanted to make a real point of. In other words, folks, I want to poke you between the eye, and I need to get your attention. What he just said in this red part, that no preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another. And it goes beyond that. The federal government cannot pick favorites. They are to be neutral. They are to make sure that the states are actually on even ground at all times. To make sure that, you know, and they don't have a job to equalize, that no advantages are being given by them. That's the point. They're to make sure that everybody has equal. So how do they do it? Well, if we're going to import stuff that we need to come into D.C., then we don't necessarily have to pick, you know, our own port, you know, this port down the, you know, Norfolk or what have you. And as a matter of fact, maybe what they need to do is use every port to make sure that they spread the wealth of the importation of things coming in, so that, you know, because the handlers of that actually get paid, right? The people that work at the ports to offload and so forth, they're getting paid to do that. And the fact is, if everything's coming into, you know, the Potomac port, which is, you know, right there in D.C. at that time, because in D.C. they actually had ships that went up to the Potomac. So you could actually get on a ship from D.C. and go anywhere along the coast, right, as long as it's sea accessible. So the point is this, is that they had no ability, and technically they should have been bending over backwards to ensure that they weren't, because they became a big consumer of different types of goods, different types of materials. They should have been bending over backwards, but they probably didn't, because they probably were just going, well, it's the cheapest for us to bring it into our own port. And then the port of Potomac went away, and so the next close port is Norfolk. And so when commercial products are coming in, that the federal government's purchasing those commercial products, supplies, what have you, then they're giving an advantage. That when they say, okay, all shipping stuff is coming through, that's picking a port. I'm maybe, you know, stuck on this like a broken record. I'm hoping you get this, because this applies to everything. When the federal government is involved, they're not to be making, you know, any advantages or disadvantages. So last little part of the rat hole. When we look at these infrastructure bills, where they say, you know what, we're going to, you know, start building roads and so forth. What do? They go and create contracts to the contractors that they want to ingratiate. In other words, the unions that they want to actually bolster up and give them these jobs and so forth. And so as they throw the money down there, that actually, you know, gets swallowed up and basically becomes kickbacks for them. Because they take that money and they use that money to make sure you get back in office. This is how it happens every time in every way. And so this is one of the reasons why they weren't to have any involvement in domestic matters like infrastructure, housing, healthcare. Look at what they're doing. They are picking favorites every time and every point. So my point is, this is big, and it's important for you to understand this, that they were supposed to be neutral in every capacity.
Okay, we've got a tiny bit left.
Oh, yeah, we got a minute left. Okay, so with that, that's a good point to stop right there. And so Mr. Davies is bringing up ex post facto laws and all of these other things. And so actually, I go out of my way when I see people talking about the states doing things like passing laws that, you know, take away your water rights, or passing laws that you have to get a electric car. You know, they're banning, you know, gas cars, gas stoves, gas heaters, all those types of things. And so as they do that, tell me, folks, how? Tell me how. That is not an ex post facto law or a bill of attainder or punishment. People need to understand that the states can't and the federal government cannot pass ex post facto laws or bills of attainder and punishment. They're forbidden. The Constitution actually forbids them to do this. And so if we start pointing out, you know, how our states are actually violating the Constitution by passing this law, then, that actually starts waking people up. And we have to start applying Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So with that, we're going to go into a break. And then when we come back, then Tammy can kind of pick this up, you know, regarding the emissions of bills and currencies and so forth. These are the restrictions placed upon states as well as the federal government, because you'll find that both 9 and 10 kind of parallel. But anyway, we'll be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so without any further ado, now we can lean forward into the rest of these comments. So, by all means, I yield.
Okay. All right, and that no state shall emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver, coin a tender in payment of debts, pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts. That was the end of the quote. These restrictions ought to supersede the laws of particular states. With respect to prohibitory provision, that no duty or impost shall be laid by any particular state, which is so highly in favor of us that the other non-importing states, the importing states might make laws laying duties notwithstanding, and the Constitution might be violated with impunity if there were no power in the general government to correct and counteract such laws. This great object can only be safely and completely obtained by the instrumentality of the federal judiciary. Would not Virginia, who has raised many thousand pounds out of our citizens by her imposts, still avail herself of the same advantage if there were no constitutional power to counteract her regulations? If cases arising under the Constitution were left to her own courts, might she not still continue the same practices? But we are now to look for justice to the controlling power of the judiciary of the United States. If the Virginians were to continue to oppress us by laying duties, we can be relieved by a recurrence to the general judiciary. This restriction in the Constitution is a fundamental principle which is not to be violated, but which would have been a dead letter were there no judiciary constituted to enforce obedience to it. Paper money and private contracts were in the same condition. Without a general controlling judiciary, laws might be made in particular states to enable its citizens to defraud the citizens of other states. Is it probable, if a citizen of South Carolina owned a sum of money to a citizen of this state, that the latter would be certain of recovering the full value in their courts? That state might in future, as they have already done, make pine barren acts to discharge their debts. They might say that our citizens should be paid in sterile, in arable lands at an extravagant price. They might pass the most iniquitous installment laws, procrastinating the payment of debts due from their citizens for years, nay, for ages. Is it probable that we should get justice from their own judiciary, who might consider themselves obliged to obey the laws of their own state? Where, then, are we to look for justice? To the judiciary of the United States. Gentlemen must have observed the contracted and narrow-minded regulations of the individual states and their predominant disposition to advance the interest of their own citizens to the prejudice of others. Will not these evils be continued if there be no restraint? The people of the United States have one common interest. They are all members of the same community and ought to have justice administered to them equally in every part of the continent, in the same manner, with the same dispatch, and on the same principles. It is therefore absolutely necessary that the judiciary of the Union should have jurisdiction in all cases arising in law and equity under the Constitution. Surely there should be somewhere a constitutional authority for carrying into execution constitutional provisions. Otherwise, as I have already said, they would be a dead letter.
Okay, so he's really kind of going through a lot of the stuff that we've covered, right? And he kind of says, arising in law and equity under the Constitution. Again, I'm going to just highlight that because I didn't have it that way. But he's basically talking about the jurisdiction of the courts, right? The judiciary of the union should have jurisdiction in all cases arising in law and equity under the Constitution. In other words, only those things. So you don't appeal if, you know, you don't like the punishment for murder in your state. You don't appeal to the federal government and say, hey, we don't like the death penalty. So that doesn't arise under this Constitution, so we can't hear that case. It has basically been fully resolved by your Supreme Court. You don't like it. If the people of that state don't like it, then they need to change their laws. That makes sense, right? Of course, yeah. The person that's been found guilty will not like it. And every, you know, this is always, you know, it's even in comedies as well as in, you know, real, I'll just say, serious movies, crime dramas, what have you. Everybody that's in jail, oh, well, I was innocent. They all say they're innocent. And so they're all going to want to have another appeal. Can I, and then let me get to the next level. The levels stop. Why is it that there's an unlimited level? Why is it you can go back and back and back and back? Why, folks? Why is there this revolving door in trying to give people who have actually... I'm a fan of letting a guilty man go so that no innocent man ever goes to prison. That's the whole point of our legal system. A shadow of doubt, right? So we need to actually stop, you know, going down this path of making sure that, you know, at least somebody's held accountable. Well, no, the person that actually committed the crime needs to be held accountable. And we got to quit allowing circumstantial evidence in convicting people. We need to actually point out this is circumstantial. Well, we're connected to the dots and we want justice to be served. So you're going to jail, buddy, whether you did it or not. That's all repugnant and wrong. My point is that when we look at the paradigm of those people being incarcerated, one, it should be very, the standard of getting incarcerated should be very, very high. You know, we look at, you know, how they go out of their way, bend over backwards to help the guilty, but it's not the guilty. It is the bending over backwards to make sure that every person has a fighting chance to create the, you know, some shadow of doubt. Because if there's a shadow of doubt, you can't convict. We're not supposed to be convicting. But it seems today that we, America, wants just, not justice, they want vengeance. You know, for O.J. Simpson, white people want to convict all black people. Now, I don't think that's the case, but, I mean, that's the paradigm that everybody carries around. Because that's the paradigm of black people. You know, all the white people want to convict us. So we ought to convict them. Two wrongs make a right. Isn't that right? I mean, everybody's mom has told us that. Yeah, two wrongs, that makes a right. So, in my sarcasm, the point, I think, he makes great points in here of how important it is that we need to maintain these separations of jurisdiction. That's it. If they don't, if it's not under the Constitution, the federal courts don't have the say. They're not done. Don't go there. Every time you walk into a federal court and they don't have jurisdiction, you've just surrendered your sovereignty to them. That's exactly what you've done. Okay, so interposition. Now this little paragraph right here. Do we have time for this? Yeah, we do. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, with respect to their having jurisdiction of all cases arising under the laws of the United States, although I have a very high respect for the gentleman, I heard his objection to it with surprise. I thought if there were any political axiom under the sun, it must be that the judicial power ought to be coextensive with the legislative. The federal government ought to possess the means of carrying the laws into execution. This position will not be disputed. A government would be a filo de se, to put the execution of its laws under the control of any other body. If laws are not to be carried into execution by the interposition of the judiciary, how is it to be done?
There you go. So, moving on, we're going to now go into paper money and bills of and Bill of Rights. And this is still Mr. Davy. Go ahead.
Okay. The security of impartiality is the principal reason for giving up the ultimate design of controversies between the citizens of different states. It is essential to the interest of agriculture and commerce that the hands of the state should be bound from making paper money, installment laws, or Pine Barren Acts. By such iniquitous laws, the merchant or farmer may be defrauded of a considerable part of his just claims. But in the federal court, real money will be recovered with that speed which is necessary to accommodate the circumstances of individuals. The tedious delays of judicial proceedings at present in some states are ruinous to creditors. In Virginia, many suits are 20 or 30 years spun out by legal ingenuity and the defective construction of their judiciary. A citizen of Massachusetts or this country might be ruined before he could recover a debt in that state. It is necessary, therefore, in order to obtain justice, that we recur to the judiciary of the United States, where justice must be equally administered and where the debt may be recovered from the citizen of one state as soon as from the citizen of another. As to the Bill of Rights, which has been brought forward in a manner I cannot account for, it is unnecessary to say anything. The learned gentleman has said that by a concurrent jurisdiction, the laws of the United States must necessarily clash with the laws of the individual states, in consequence of which the laws of the states will be obstructed and the state governments absorbed. This cannot be the case. There is not one instance of a power given to the United States whereby the internal policy or administration of the states is affected. There is no instance that can be pointed out wherein the internal policy of the state can be affected by the judiciary of the United States. He mentioned impost laws. It has been given up on all hands that if there was a necessity of a federal court, it was on this account. Money is difficult to be got into the treasury. The power of the judiciary to enforce the federal laws is necessary to facilitate the collection of the public revenues. It is well known in this state with what reluctance and backwardness collectors pay up the public monies. We have been making laws after laws to remedy this evil and still find them ineffectual. It is not, therefore, necessary to enable the general government. Oh, this is a question. Is it not, therefore, necessary to enable the general government to compel the delinquent receivers to be punctual? The honorable gentleman admits that the general government ought to legislate upon individuals instead of states.
Okay, so one of the things that jumps out to me, and it kind of is in the last sentence, and he kind of repeats it again. It is necessary, therefore, in order to obtain justice, that we recur to the judiciary of the United States, where justice must be equally administered and where a debt may be recovered from the citizen of one state as soon as from a citizen of another, or from one state to another, and so forth. Why am I bringing this up? Remember, I keep on talking about this concept of punitive damages. The intent is justice. The intent is to repay what was taken, to renew, restore. It is not to hurt people. Our judiciary has created a civil law judiciary where, if you can't get justice, you know, in the crimes, on the crime level, then come and, you know, sue for civil damages, and we'll punish them that way. Civil lawsuits where you basically, that's what they did to O.J. Simpson, right? And there's a term for it, but, you know, the type of case it was, because it was civil. And it was a punitive, to hit him with punitive damages. That is civil law. That has no place in America. It's one thing to take something from every, you know, from a person. Like, look at the Tory Acts. Was that civil law? No. When you've reneged, so basically, this is the paradigm of the Tory Acts. I don't dive into this. I probably should every year. I should actually say this. That when you look at a person that has come here and they've made themselves based on the liberties of the land here, and then all of a sudden they've, you know, perverted them, their position where they don't want liberty for everybody, just for them. And so they start supporting a system or supporting an old system, and specifically in the Tory Acts, these were citizens that supported the old system, Britain, and were supporting Britain specifically. Therefore, all those things that they obtained here, they lost. In other words, we're sending you back to Britain, or you were kicking you out of the United States. You can't stay here, but you're going empty-handed. Because while you were here, you benefited from the laws of this land. And you have made, all, like Bill Gates. Bill Gates ought to be ran out of the nation. Soros, all of these people that have money that are sitting here running insurrections against the Constitution, they need to be grabbed, all of their assets taken, and ran out of the United States. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, they should go to either Cuba or down to, what is it, Venezuela, right? Wherever, that's the we're not spending a lot of money for you to, you know, get to your communist state. We'll either throw you over there in Cuba or maybe down to Venezuela, because your chance of survival down in Venezuela goes down a lot. But that's the paradigm. When you renege on your responsibility to support the law, remember, what is one of the definitions of a republican form of government? So you may want to remember this, because folks, if you can't recite this off the top of your head to help people understand what a republican form of government is, you need to. So there are two factors. A republican form of government is a government. Now, in the world, they look at a republican form of government that is a government that is representative of the people. Therefore, the people elect their representatives. In America, a republican form of government is a representative of the sovereigns, because we actually have multiple levels of government in America, which means that each government that we create is a sovereign in the capacity as created. The counties have been given certain powers. And unfortunately, they don't have a constitution delegating those things. We need to fix that. But that doesn't mean they're not a legitimate government. They have been created. We just need to take ownership of them. But once we have a county constitution, then you can go into your state constitution and determine what we really want them to do or not, based on what you want your counties to do. This is why everything has been turned upside down. As we move forward to the federal level, we recognize that in both the state level, the county was represented in the Senate. And at the federal level, the states were represented in the Senate, which means that we have a representative government of our sovereigns, where we, the people, are represented in the House, and our government is represented in the Senate at that level of government. That makes sense, right? So a republican form of government is a representative government of the sovereigns in America, which is the we the people and the governments we create. The other part, the second part of a republican form of government, is it is based on the rule of law, that the law is the king. We don't have kings. The law is the supreme being in our nation. And so we don't have kings, we have the law as our king. If the law states right. This, then that's what we must face. That's what we must force. That's what we must follow. And if we're not happy with that, we actually have a mode or a process in Article 5 to change that law. By amending the Constitution, by granting new powers or taking away powers, what have you. So that's the whole point. A republican form of government is one that is representative of the sovereigns in America, representative of the sovereigns, and the law is king. where we don't have a king, we don't have a ruler, the government is not our ruler, the law is our ruler. That's why the Constitution is considered the supreme law of the land. Okay, not the federal government, the Constitution. All right, so now we can jump down to the paper money by Mr. Locke.
Such reasoning is very strange to me. I fear greatly for this state and for other states. I find there has a considerable stress been laid upon the injustice of laws made heretofore. Great reflections are thrown on South Carolina for passing Pine Barren and installment laws, and on this state for making paper money. I wish those gentlemen who made those observations would consider the necessity which compelled us in a great measure to make such money. I never thought the law which authorized it a good law. If the evil could have been avoided, it would have been a very bad law, but necessity, sir, justified it. But necessity, sir, justified it in some degree. I believe I have gained as little by it as any in this house. If we are to judge of the future by what we have seen, we shall find as much or more injustice in Congress than in our legislature. Necessity compelled them to pass the law in order to save vast numbers of people from ruin. I hope to be excused in observing that it would have been hard for our late Continental Army to lay down their arms, with which they had valiantly and successfully fought for their country, without receiving or being promised and assured of some compensation for their past services. What a situation would this country have been in if they had had the power over the purse and sword? If they had had the powers given up by this Constitution, what a wretched situation would this country have been in? Congress was unable to pay them, but passed many resolutions and laws in their favor, particularly one that each state should make up the depreciation of the pay of the Continental Line, who were distressed for the want of an adequate compensation for their services. This state could not pay her proportion in specie. To have laid a tax for that purpose would have been oppressive. What was to be done? The only expedient was to pass a law to make paper money and make it a tender. The Continental Line was satisfied and approved of the measure, it being done at their instance in some degree. Notwithstanding, it was supposed to be highly beneficial to the state. It is found to be injurious to it. Saving expense is a very great object, but this incurred much expense. This subject has for many years embroiled the state, but the situation of the country and the distress of the people are so great that the public measures must be accommodated to their circumstances with peculiar delicacy and caution, or another insurrection may be the consequence. As to what the gentleman said of the trial by jury, it surprises me much to hear gentlemen of such great ability speak such language. It is clearly insecure, nor can ingenuity and subtle arguments prove the contrary. I trust this country is too sensible of the value of liberty, and her citizens have bought it too dearly to give it up hastily.
Okay, so as we jump down to Mr. Iredell, he dives into jurisdiction and a little bit more, but then Mr. Archibald McLean covers paper money. So let me see, we got 4 minutes, so let's see if we can get through the green and maybe the yellow. Let's see what we can get through. Go ahead.
Okay, so we're on jurisdiction, right?
Yeah, we're on...
Okay.
Yeah, Iredell jurisdiction, correct.
Oh. Okay. We have been told, and I believe this is the real reason, why they could not concur in any general rule. I have great respect for the characters of those gentlemen who formed the convention, and I believe they were not capable of overlooking the importance of the trial by jury, much less of designedly plotting against it. But I fully believe that the real difficulty of the thing was the clause of the omission. I trust sufficient reasons have been offered to show that it is in no danger. As to criminal cases, I must observe that the great instrument of arbitrary power is is criminal prosecutions. By the privileges of the habeas corpus, no man can be confined without inquiry, and if it should appear that he has been committed contrary to law, he must be discharged. That diversity which is to be found in civil controversies does not exist in criminal cases. That diversity which contributes to the security of property in civil cases would have pernicious effects in criminal ones. There is no other safe mode to try these but by a jury. If any man had the means of trying another his own way, or were it left to the control of arbitrary judges, no man would have that security for life and liberty which every freedom ought to have.
Okay, so let's keep going, because I think you can get through probably at least half this. So let's go through half.
Okay. I presume that in no state on the continent is a man tried on a criminal accusation but by a jury. It was necessary, therefore, that it should be fixed in the Constitution that the trial should be by jury in criminal cases, and such difficulties did not occur in this as in the other case. The worthy gentleman says that by not being provided for in civil cases, it is expressly provided against, and that what is not expressed is given up. Were it so, no man would be more against this Constitution than myself. I should detest and oppose it as much as any man. But, sir, this cannot be the case. I beg leave to say that construction appears to me absurd and unnatural. As it could not be fixed either on the principles of uniformity or diversity, it must be left to Congress to modify it. If they establish it in any manner by law and find it inconvenient, they can alter it. But I am convinced that a majority of the representatives of the people will never attempt to establish a mode oppressive to their constituents, as it will be their own interest to take care of this right. But it is observed that there ought to be a fence provided against future encroachments of power. If there be not such a fence, it is a cause of objection. I readily agree that there ought to be such a fence.
Okay, so now there's a fence.
An instrument.
All right. Yeah. All right, so we've covered that section. So when we come back, we'll dive into the next green section. And so with the green, yellow, and so forth, it's, you know, just kind of, you know, just segregating these different ideas and arguments. Bottom line, folks, Mr. Iredell, I think he keeps on coming back and basically pointing out that they're assuming that because it's not there, they can't do it. And that's correct. If it's not there, then they can't do it. If it is there, then they can do it. What we have to be worried about is because, bottom line, if a case comes up to the court in appeal, they will be trying that case based on the common law and the system that state produced, if that makes sense. In other words, they're going to basically follow the common law process because they are designed to basically accommodate the differences of legal systems, as it was stated so many times. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.